Well, hello, Greg. Welcome to Iconocast.
Hey, Mike, how's it going?
Going pretty well. It's been a little while since we've done the last one, and just thought it'd be a good idea just to chat about some of the ideas that we've been kicking around the last few days and been thinking about what people can do in their daily lives. One of the things that we do know from talking to Michael Mann on a previous podcast is that as individuals, there's really not a lot that we can do that will overall change the course of what's happening with the global warming. It's anthropogenic, but we can do things in our daily lives that will help us keep mindful of the effects that we have on the environment and what we can do. Time for that?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. Well, these are some of the things that I do. So I realized that when I wash my clothes, they're really not filthy, dirty, like as if I worked on a farm or something like that. I work in an office, I work at home. And so my washer has like a short cycle that only takes about 25 minutes to run through a cycle. And so that reduces the amount of energy uses as well as the amount of water that's used. The other thing that I do is I use cold water, and there's a couple of reasons it saves energy on heating the water for the wash. But also, if we talk about plastic, it gets microplastics that get into the environment from synthetic clothes and so forth. When we wash with cold water, it tends to shed less plastic, and then that is a smaller load for our environment to carry in the rivers and so forth, and down into where the fish eat plastics and it gets in their gills and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And my clothes are still clean enough, so I think I'm happy with it.
I do the laundry in this household. And what I find amazing is I think that my family and I think we change our clothes like 5 times a day, because it doesn't matter how much. I can't like wait 3 days to do the laundry. It's amazing. It just builds up. But getting the loads as full as possible using cold water. One way I think about this kind of thing, it's not exactly what I do, but other people do it, is when you travel and you don't have as much opportunity to do your clothing. I spend a lot of time like on the road in foreign lands. And so what you do, doing farm work, although actually archaeology or other dirty work. So at the end of the day, your clothes are completely dirty. So at that point, you take your shower or bath in the river and change into your cleaner clothes. Then those are the same clothes you use in the next morning. So in other words, where you put your change of clothes in your daily cycle might be inefficient.
Oh, sure.
Maybe move that so the clothes last longer somehow between washing. And then, of course, owning the clothes that you need so that you don't have to do the laundry as often.
Right.
Like sometimes I find myself thinking I need to do laundry now because my son doesn't have any shirts. You know, he's not that big and he's tall, but he's not wide at all. So his shirts don't take up any space in laundry at all. Getting a load that's worth doing takes longer. So instead I just buy 3 more shirts. You're going to use them anyway. It's not really excessive materialism. It just means your shirts are going to last 6, 8, 12 months longer, or 2 years longer, or whatever.
Right.
Then you're filling the loads.
Yeah. Might as well make it worth your while. Right. The next thing that I got, and I was lucky that I was in the house when I bought the house, because they're really nice to have, is the water heater that was in this house is a tankless water heater. And I don't know if you've got one of those or if you've got the big, tall 100-gallon or 80-gallon water heater that basically just, tries to keep the water at a constant temperature.
Yeah, that's what we have.
It turns off and on. The tankless water heater basically just has a series of coils that the water runs through as you turn on your faucet, and as it's running through there, that gets heated up. And so it only heats up the water that's going to be needed for whatever your particular purpose is, whether it's washing your hands or taking a shower. And so you're not using gas or electricity throughout the day when you're not here to keep water warm. That's just not going to get used for a while anyway. And so that's definitely a much more efficient way. And the nice thing I like about it is that if I have guests over to the house, I don't have to worry about being cold and naked towards the end of the shower when I still got shampoo in my hair.
Oh, so it works really well in that sense.
Oh, yeah. I've had three or four people over here and all taking showers and didn't have an issue with it. Whereas my ex-wife, she had a 25 gallon water heater. And so when my daughter stayed over there one Christmas, she said she barely got her hair washed and all of a sudden it turned cold. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I was happened to be walking by the water tank. We had the traditional kind the other day, and I heard the gas ignite. You know, yeah. It was warming up. It's like no one's using the water right now, but it's keeping it warm. And I'll just add to that. I think that's right. I'll just add to that. When someone's thinking about getting an appliance to replace something that exists now, if you are thinking about getting a methane-based appliance, you are thinking immoral thoughts. Now, you might not have the choice for some reason,
right?
But I really like to cook on a gas stove. It's not a good enough reason to destroy the planet. You got to put an electric stove in there when you're replacing a gas stove.
Yeah.
And you've got to have an electric water heater if you can possibly do that. I don't know if yours is electric or not, but if you could possibly have electric appliances. And of course, obviously, the big problem we have right now, and whenever I have an opportunity to talk to legislators about this, I'm always saying we need a bill that makes it easy for anybody to upgrade their heating and cooling system to heat pumps and their water heating to an efficient water heating system. Anybody who owns a house should be able to do that without it breaking the bank. It should be completely accessible to everybody, including landlords, I suppose, and small businesses.
For me to change over to electric, I would need to have like an electrician come out and put in a 220 volt circuit in there and strengthen. Because I do have gas for my range,
yeah,
and for my dryer, as well as my furnace. So it would be a changeover, and if they would have a program where they get like low cost loans or something like that for people to do that, that would be great. Because and you're probably aware that most of the time in cities with older houses, like in St. Paul and Minneapolis, where houses were built in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, we still have an older housing stock. You're going to find that most of the appliances are going to be gas.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, the house I grew up in had gas lights. They had been capped off. We weren't working anymore.
Yeah.
But they, that's another, that's more like 1880s, 1890s.
Yeah.
But yeah, we need to have the equivalent of the urban electrification program that we went through in this country in the 30s, whenever that was. For that upgrade you're talking about, shouldn't even be something you shouldn't have to pay for. It should just be something that we go out and we do, and the utilities cover it. And maybe you pay a little, but it's just something that goes on your bill and you don't even notice it because it's done over a long time. We've got to get everybody upgraded so that they can put in their car charger, they can put in electrify all their appliances. If we want to do decarbonization and electrification, we have to push people to do it. And if you want to have that where you get fined if you don't do it, or it's a tax break if you do. Those are only going to work a little bit. We just have to show up and solve the problem and do it.
And it's a myth that cooking is better on gas than it is on electricity. I cook a lot. People tend to think that the instant on is nicer, but with modern stoves, I stayed with my cousin up in Vatnais Heights before I moved into this house when I first moved back to Minnesota. And the stove that she had, I thought, worked a lot better than gas. Quite improved from the old burners. Now the new stovetops, I think, are really good.
Yeah, they're actually quite good, and you could use your cast iron on them.
That's right.
You can. That's right. So yeah, I cook with I always like cooking with gas, and I cook a lot. But moving last house we were in was electric, and actually we had the choice. Our gas was old and leaky. So we pulled it out behind it was the circuitry for electric.
Hey, nice.
So we went, just switched to electric right there. And it was a nice new, not expensive. Yeah. So,
well, one of the things that people don't realize is how much water it uses when you wash your dishes by hand. Mm-hmm. This is one of the things that, you know, I lived in Arizona and I was always conscious about how much water I was using. Like even when I would go into Planet Fitness and take a shower, I would, you know, turn the water off, suds my hair, and then turn the water back on to rinse it. mm-hmm. as I could, just because I was thinking about the Colorado River drying up, and I didn't want to be the one that dried it up the most. And so
that's when he had longer hair, and it took a lot longer to soap up
right,
your hair.
Right? Yeah, my hair was longer then. You know, I was hippie-ish for sure. So I started looking into whether or not it was more efficient to wash dishes by hand or by a dishwasher. And with high efficiency dishwashers, they are effective enough at keeping the rinse water clean that they only need to use about 3 gallons of water while washing a full load, or 3 to 4 gallons while hand washing and rinsing in the sink can use up to 20 gallons because you're continuously rinsing off and refilling your soap and so forth. So,
yeah.
And again, that since we prefer to use hot water, then again, you're using energy to heat the water that you're using. So there's two phases or two reasons for doing that.
Yeah, that's true. And it turns out, by the way, that if you take an environmental science AP exam, mm-hmm. or a class in that, that's a commonly one of the problems you might have to work out. You're given information about, you know, how many BTUs it takes to heat up water.
Right.
Well, that's what the BTU is. And, you know, what your typical water temperature is. The typical dishwasher heats the water to a higher degree than you use in a sink. And so it takes more energy per unit water to heat it. But you're using so much less water that it's a no-brainer. It's a huge difference. And then you get to use some very hot water in your dishes, which cleans them better.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Because you don't have to worry about burning your hands or having hot water that's uncomfortable when it's in the dishwasher.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, people are sensitive to hot water and don't turn it on as hot as they probably could otherwise.
Right. So one thing though worth quickly mentioning, I don't know how true this is, but just something I worry about a little bit, is if you buy an appliance, like if you have an old appliance in your house, like a dishwasher, so you know about how much energy it takes. Mm-hmm. You need to go to the store to buy a new one, and it says this is 50% more efficient than the one you probably have.
Right.
Then you take it home, install it, and then run it, and it turns out that the energy saving setting is the minimalistic setting. And that's maybe the one you should use if you can. But if you add on extra rinse, extra wash, extra heat, blah, 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 then suddenly you're back up to your original dishwasher. Yeah. Because they've been making dishwashers now long enough. There's been Energy Star appliances now for how many years? 30 years.
Oh, yeah.
So there's been some attention has been paid to this for several decades. So there may not be much of a difference. So when you're thinking about what to do, getting a more efficient dishwasher, it might be a falsehood. And you're better off getting your electric appliance replaced with some gas appliance in your house. There are no gas dishwashers that I know of.
I don't think so. No.
But, you know.
Not even sure how that would work. But. Well, and then, speaking of that extra services that you can, you know, extra buttons that you push. I mean, I know a lot of people like to have their dishes dry when they open them up.
Right.
So they'll push the dry button for an added dry cycle where it just puts dry heat through there.
Yeah.
But if you just open up the dishwasher slightly and maybe use a towel to keep it open, then you can let your dishes air dry without tripping over the door.
Yeah. Even tripping over the door sounds so bad because it reminds you to empty the dishwasher.
Right.
And I find that dishes are so hot. I open it up, and if you open up right away, they're so hot, they just dry themselves up instantly in the air. Except for some things that are made out of certain kinds of plastic. And I use the word plastic loosely. I don't know if it's really plastic. Like Rubbermaid containers just sit there with water beating all over them. So I just put those out on the counter and put them away later today, you know. But yeah, I've never used that thing. Any dishwasher I have, if you turn that on, it will catch on fire. I've never used it. And now it's covered with a layer of whatever that would be, calcrete. From the water and the soap.
Yeah. Calgon. I've switched from bottle shampoo, like in a plastic bottle, to a bar shampoo when I'm showering. And really about the big advantage of that is the fact that it cuts down the amount of plastic that is used for the bottles. And I think it actually cuts down the amount of actual shampoo that's used too.
Yeah, and shipping, because you're not shipping water. Mm-hmm. Shampoo is mostly water, so.
Right.
I've also done that. The first time I did it though, I ordered something and I found out when it came from, I think it was Australia. So I don't think I saved on the shipping cost that much. Who knows though, you know, but yeah, the bar soap, it works great. And you can, you're not doing that plastic. You're not putting that plastic in the recycling. It's not being shipped around as much. Mm-hmm. And the soap tends to, the trick is, so I didn't have a problem with this, but some people have complained. You got to find a good way to store it in your shower. It's not up and out of the way of it's not melting under the water that's spraying on it by accident.
Yeah. I got a rack, and kind of an open rack at Target that has a suction cup, and I put it at the far end of the shower so it's not sitting under the running water. And it's got my hair shampoo bar on one side, and then I've got my old fashioned ivory soap on the other. It's like, do the same thing. I don't use body wash anymore. I use that for a lot of years, but I think people waste a lot of body wash and use a lot more of body wash than you really need in the soap. All you really want to do is just break down the resistance of the water so that can rinse off your dirt on your body. It's not, you don't need to have a lot.
Yeah.
And then sticking with that, since I've been cutting my hair pretty short due to the pandemic, and that's the only way I can cut my hair because I can't style my own hair. Right. So I just take a trimmer and just trim over my head.
All right.
So that's allowed me, because I'm kind of vain as far as how my hair looks. When my hair is shorter, I don't have to shower every day. And so showering every other day or every third day, you know, is certainly satisfactory, especially since I've been working at home. But even when I go back to work, I think I still look okay when I haven't showered my hair and washed my hair that day. Mm-hmm. Still use deodorant every day, of course, but that's another way to save
the
environment. You talked about like an AP environmental science course. I actually took one when I was at Metropolitan State and getting my bachelor's degree. And I did a calculation on what my carbon footprint was. And at the time I was living in North Phoenix and I was working in Tempe. And in Phoenix, I don't know if you've ever really spent much time there or if our listeners have spent much time there, but when you are in the north and you kind of work downtown, there's really only one freeway that you can take to get to work, and that's the 51. It kind of goes in this through central Phoenix, but everybody has to take that because of the mountains. You can't really get around it, and so there's a lot of sitting still on the freeway. Mm-hmm. And I had a fairly efficient car. It was a Kia Soul. They got about 25 to 30 miles to the gallon in town, and about 33 or 34 on the highway. But that was not sitting in traffic. However, it wasn't really the amount of gas that I was using, but the fact that I spent a lot of time sitting still on the freeway, knowing that there was an emission that was coming out of the back of the car that was going up into the air. And that's part of what's causing global warming, is the carbon emissions. And so once I did the carbon footprint thing and realized how much I was trying to save was offset by the fact that I was just kind of commuting in a car that made me sit for 25 or 30 minutes in traffic, along with all the other thousands of cars that were beside me. I made a decision to trade in the Kia Soul, and I bought a Kia Niro hybrid. So I didn't really have a way to use an electric car, but I think hybrids are pretty good alternatives for that, because of the fact that a lot of your city driving is going to be on battery that's chargeable when you're driving your car, when you stop and you brake. So,
and the engine is not running when you're sitting there.
Exactly.
It unless it's, it might be running to charge your battery sometimes, but it's independent.
Yep. Yeah, so, yeah. Or else if it needs to, you know, it'll turn off and on, you know, depending on if it needs the air conditioning, and it needs the air conditioning quite a bit in Phoenix, of course.
Right.
But it certainly is much reduced. And then and here's a nice thing. I've got a friend that's got a Ford F-150 that I just bought. He lives down in Shakopee. And he said it has the auto stop start in it. So even people that feel like they really need to have a big powerful engine can really, you know, do a lot by getting, even if you have to have like an 8-cylinder car,
right,
you know, or truck.
Right.
Just the fact that you've got that option on your car so that you're not polluting while you're sitting there, I think is pretty good.
Right. Yeah. We as a family did something major to cut carbon. We basically took what was, could have been on, well, close to an hour commute or more per day, both ways, you know, right, in total, down to 11 minutes. And also got a hybrid at the same time.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So our carbon footprint went down to a fraction of what it was before. And compared to the average American, which includes people who drive great distances because they're rural or big distances because they're suburban, right, as well as urban people who don't drive much, our carbon footprint is way, way low because under normal conditions, because it commutes so low. During COVID isolation, of course, it was much lower, but that made a big difference.
Yeah, that's right. It's got to be just, you know, I think from where you are to where the school is, it's got to be just a quick hop, skip, and a jump, basically, where you used to be.
Right.
Yeah. For people that listened to our last podcast, where we talked to Bill Schutt, it was a two-part episode. First episode, you and Bill talked about, it was because this was on the heart, why there's heart attacks that tend to happen after the first snowfall or during a particularly heavy snowfall every year. And there was one thing that you forgot when you were talking about it, you forgot to mention the fact that, you know, snowblowers work pretty good to prevent heart attacks.
Yeah.
And I've got one.
Is it electric?
It's electric. It uses rechargeable battery to power it. So I don't use gas on it.
Excellent. Excellent. And you like it?
I really do. Well, actually, this is the fourth one. I've had to have them replaced. and they've replaced them free and they've shipped them out. When I ship it back, I don't send back the batteries. When they return them, they send me a new set of batteries and a charger. So I can just, if I use up the batteries, then I don't have to worry about waiting until the battery charges.
So, right.
Swap
them out. Okay, that's interesting. Everybody I know who has electric appliances like that really likes them.
Yeah.
You know, lawnmowers. And in the old days, there was an electric lawnmower that you could get, but it used a cord.
Right.
And of course,
ran over the cord.
Right. Anybody who has, more common was the hedge clipper with a cord.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody used to go watch people doing that, and you just look down the cord, and you can see, okay, there's the part of the cord you cut, the close part. Then there's a farther part you cut. And then it is all taped up, but that's okay. I mean, that technology isn't wrong. In some industrial settings where diesel trucks are being replaced with electric trucks,
right?
Like in mining, those trucks go back and forth in the same exact road again and again for a decade. So they don't have batteries. They're like a trolley. They have a cable overhead. Sure. And they're just plugged in.
Yeah. I suppose, like up in Hibbing, around like in the big open pit, they might be using those now. Then, huh?
They are. I don't know what they're doing right now, but at least about a year ago, they were buying them at that time.
Were they?
Yeah. So I don't know what's being employed now, but yeah.
For anybody that goes up to Hibbing, if you want to see something, I mean, it's a big open scar on the land, but it is kind of fantastic in a way. But I mean that open ore iron pit up in Hibbing is hard to figure out. It's hard to realize just how big it is until you go there. Now, I don't know if you know it, but back in the 20s, they actually had to move the whole town of Hibbing 1 mile so that they could extend the pit.
Really?
and just put all the, they just took up everything and they put them up on these rolling logs and just slid them, moved it over a mile.
The whole town. Wow.
Yeah, including Abe Zimmerman's appliance store.
And that Abe was Abe Bob Dylan's uncle or somebody. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. It is amazing. And of course, there's a lot of minerals in northern Minnesota. This is off the topic, but it's if the mining interests get what they want, they will mine the entire northern half, third of the state. You know, it's pretty amazing how much mining they want to do there.
Well, yeah, and Rebecca Otto might be somebody we can talk to sometime. She did a lot of work when she was an auditor on the nickel, the proposed nickel sulfide mine. In the damage that could do. and those were seven or eight different things that you can do in your everyday life. They might not completely turn around global warming, but they certainly can help keep your conscience clear, but also keep you a little bit mindful about some of the things that we as individuals can do to contribute. But the important thing is to talk to your legislators. Make sure that they have a good understanding, a good grasp of the issue, and they'll be able to work for you. And this last weekend, District 67A, which is the east side of St. Paul, had its convention. We have basically an open seat for the 67A legislator. And so a week ago Sunday, I had a visitor to my door, and this was Liz Lee, who's running to fill the seat. She's a young woman that used to work for Keith Ellison in Congress when he was in Congress. And she worked with Tim Mahoney when he was in the state legislature in Minnesota. And she came to the door, and she was like the first person that came to the door after I was named as a delegate. And she asked me what issues that I had. Well, it just so happened that I had gotten some info from MN350, a climate project. And they were talking about funding that would be available for the state of Minnesota to switch over most of our mass transit buses from diesel buses over to electric. And so I talked to her about the advantages of those, not only from the energy, but also the effect that the particles have since buses run heavier in poor neighborhoods. They tend to have kids developing asthma more frequently than they used to, just because of the fact that they're exposed to diesel fumes from the buses. And so it has a twofold effect of clearing the air, saving the asthma, as well as cutting down on our reliance on diesel fuel in our 7-county metropolitan transit district. And so last Saturday at the convention, there was a Q&A, and somebody had turned in a question for the four candidates about what would their priorities be when they got to the legislature. And sure enough, Ms. Lee, that was exactly what she said in her response. So by being willing to talk to and work with your legislators, you can actually, just by having a conversation with them, you can start to get people in the legislature to think about different ways that they can work for the environment and for reducing global warming.
Yeah, and that actually, that's a good lead into what I do to save the environment.
Great.
All the things you suggested are things that I do, similar things, and I mentioned some of the details for us. I'm fairly active, politically active. So I help locally with a couple of groups and a couple of indivisible groups, and also with the PFL. For those who are listening outside of Minnesota, and some who are listening from inside Minnesota, I'll mention that DFL means the Democrats. It's called the DFL, Democrat Farm Labor Party in Minnesota. We don't have a Democratic Party. It's slightly different. And I'll mention that when Mike's talking about 67A, we have 67 Senate districts.
Yeah.
And every Senate district has two House representatives, and it's A and B. So we call it the A side versus the B side. So Mike's in 67A, I'm in 42B. I work with Indivisible, I work with the DFL Environmental Caucus, and we are on top of that mining issue by the way, and we endorse candidates. We interview the candidates to see which ones are more environmentally active and pick winners. And these are things that volunteers do. You can do these things as a volunteer. But to me, I like to think of it this way. I remember seeing, and I have not found this. I've not found this on YouTube or any place. It's way old. When I was really little, I saw this on TV. I don't think I dreamed it, but it was a scientist. It was like a Mr. Science.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a bowling ball hanging on a chain, suspended and still. Now, we know immediately you think of this thing where you take the bowling ball up, put it on your face, let go. And because of the laws of physics, it doesn't hit you when it comes back. But that's not what he did.
Oh,
that's not what he did. That's what everybody does now. What he did was he took an index card and he stroked it against this big, heavy bowling ball. And he didn't see anything happen. He was watching closely. He stroked again and again. And he was stroking it with a piece of paper just as it was reaching the apex movement towards him.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd be pushing it back. And in not very long, he had that giant bowling ball swinging hard from a piece of paper stroking on it. And if you have any experience with boats, you know you can do that too with boats. Like 5 or 6 people can make an ocean liner, not quite an ocean liner, but a pretty big boat at a dock starts to sway if you all push in the same direction at the same time.
Yep.
So I like to do things. So if you're an activist, this is a paradigm for being a good activist. You can go out there and yell at somebody or convince someone to do something or sign a petition. But that thing you do is going to be even more effective when you're pushing at just the right moment.
Right.
And you don't know when the right moment is necessarily, but you often do. And when you do, that's when you push. So, and I'm afraid that among my environmentalist colleagues and other people, Democrats, they don't get this and they don't even believe in it and they even are against it. So for example, when there's a hurricane, you push on global warming with a storm angle.
Right.
Like, oh, no, we must not exploit the, we have to exploit the bad things that happen.
Yeah.
We have to exploit those things.
Okay? Yeah.
The tornadoes come through. I mean, we don't know. People will tell you, we don't really know if tornadoes are increasing because of global warming. Well, we know that storms in general, all storminess, the severity of storms in general is increasing with global warming, but in weird ways sometimes. So we may see fewer hurricanes. The current research says we will have fewer hurricanes with global warming. Okay, the Atlantic has had 3 or 4 hurricanes per year now, more than it did 15 years ago. So I don't see how that's fewer. It's more, according to my version of math. 16 is more than 13, which is the average number right now. But maybe the Pacific has fewer. But the storms that we have are worse because they appear out of nowhere. They move really fast. They get really powerful and or they get really big. And where hurricanes at one time were self-regulating in the sense that they would weaken, they would, if they slowed down, they would weaken because they would churn the water underneath themselves, which would bring the water down to below the sustaining temperature.
Mm-hmm.
But because of warming, that temperature now is in effect for 100 meters or 200 meters below the surface. So they can't slow themselves down anymore. Okay. So it's like a house fire, but all the houses have a coat of gasoline. Okay. So my point is, that's off the track. My point is, the storms are for real and the fires are for real. The wildfires are for real. All those things are for real. They're all linked to global warming. And when they happen, that's a good time to push on that one issue. But I think another issue, so I want to mention 2 other kinds of things that are kind of an opposite ends of the spectrum of size. One is your representatives in the legislature at the federal level and the state level might believe in global warming. They might think it's important and they might want to do the right thing, but they forget. Or they get distracted.
Right.
So here in the Twin Cities, as our listeners may know, is the epicenter of a giant racial reckoning.
Right.
We are having, we have $3.3 billion worth of damage in Minneapolis because of the uprising. This is where the defund the police movement comes from. I mean, this is where it's all happening. And I guarantee you our legislators are sitting there worrying about this stuff right now. That's what the current legislative session is about. One of the things it's about. So where's global warming? Where's climate change? It's not the most important issue in the legislature right now, even though, in fact, it is the most important issue.
Right.
So
most important issue above all issues.
Except all the other issues are more important at any given time. So that we have to stop doing that. Whatever that is, we have to stop doing. Whatever that is of how we prioritize things, has to be done differently. Right. And then on the other end of the spectrum, and this is something where I deal with a lot, we've talked about this before recently, is among our own people. Like you mentioned, the candidate got up and said, global warming is important to me, or climate change is important to me, at the 67A convention. Right. Well, the other thing you did at your convention is you voted on resolutions.
Right.
And it might be that you had a conversation, like people could get up and talk for a minute about a resolution for or against.
They normally do that at precinct caucuses.
Well, if your convention can do it too, maybe yours didn't. Ours will, because we have Phil Adam, who's on the resolutions committee of the state. We will do it. We'll have 20 minutes, during which time people can line up and say, I really like this resolution, and they can talk about it for 45 seconds. Excuse me. Or they can say, I really hate this resolution, and tell us why. So here's a scenario that we've actually seen. Phil, who's our friend who does a lot of electric car work, gets up and says, I want to speak in favor of the resolution to blah, 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 something good about electric cars, blah, blah, blah. A few guys behind him, the guy gets up and says, I wasn't going to talk about this, but since my colleague, Mr. Adams, has said this, I want to note, we're not ready for electric cars. They're just using electricity that's made from coal. They're coal cars. We're not ready for electric cars. The technology's not there yet. That is a completely wrong statement. But the person got up and said it in front of everybody.
Right.
In a room where there's only Democrats, and everybody there is convinced global warming is important. Everybody there wants to do something about it. And they just got lied to by some guy. And maybe he did it on purpose because he's actually trying to sabotage the environmental movement. More likely than not, he just doesn't know. He has it wrong. And I encounter this constantly. The electric vehicle industry is not ready because fill in the blank. The cobalt they use in batteries, lithium, the range isn't good enough. You know, all these things that are, it doesn't work in the cold. I heard a major environmentalist say that at a meeting a couple months ago. It's too bad electric vehicles won't work in Minnesota because it's too cold here.
Huh.
Now, that 350 thing you got in the literature, that's part of a project I'm working on too with 350 to try to get trucks electrified.
Right.
And buses, and get money for buses all in those school districts. We had an interview with a company called Zeus, which is in Minnesota that makes electric trucks. They have not sold a single electric truck yet to a Minnesotan. They're making trucks for municipalities to use, and small buses, like your standard truck that like street cleaners and cherry pickers and those things. They make electric versions of all those trucks. They sell them mostly to California. Okay. Anyway, I asked the guy, how do you deal with cold? And he said, well, what do you want me to do? And I said, well, I want you to drive a truck around when it's 20 below zero. He said, okay. We're engineers. We just get the battery that has a heater in it that goes in your truck and you can drive at any temperature you want. If you're going to put your truck in Phoenix, don't buy this battery. You get 10% more range. If you're going to do it in International Falls, put this battery in instead. You won't have to worry about the temperature at all. Almost all the time, this is something you said to me the other time we were talking about this. Almost all the time, the concern someone has that makes them believe we're not ready is really an engineer's sweet dream.
Right.
The engineer is already working on it. They've already solved it. Most of the time, the problem's either already solved, it isn't really there, or it's going to be solved with existing technology. I like to point out cobalt as an example of that. People worry about cobalt and batteries. They have an idea in mind that there's a group of children in the Congo mining cobalt and being repressed. True. And then the cobalt is taken and put into Teslas. Okay. And there's a direct pipeline from children in the Congo being repressed to making Teslas. Okay. Something like 17% of the cobalt mined in total is mined in those mines. Okay. 50%. It's about 17%.
Okay.
Okay. There are other mines in the Congo that aren't that mine. There are mines in the Congo that are just normal mines. The artisanal mines where they you capture some families, drive off the parents, take the children out and make them into slaves, that's only a small number of mines. And it's also a solvable problem. Over about half the cobalt we use, right now it's about half the cobalt we use is used to make alloys.
Right.
These alloys are for metals that are used in nuclear power plants because they're high under radiation, or jet engines. Most of it's probably jet engines, high performance jet engines for military jets. If we, you know, alloys that have to take a lot of heat or radiation.
And these used in the fans, or what are they used in?
For jet? The turbines. For the turbines.
Yeah, turbines.
Yeah. So for nuclear power plants, if you want a nuclear containment vessel, you use a cobalt alloy. Okay. So I've never heard anyone say we can't build nuclear power plants because of the children in the Congo.
Yeah.
I've never heard anyone say we can't build jet planes because of the children in the Congo. I mean, right. People probably do say that, and it's true. But when you talk about let's get some jets for Ukraine, no one says, wait a minute, there's children in the Congo mining cobalt. Nobody says that. But if you said, let's buy some school buses, people will say that. So it's not because people are, but the reason obviously is because these are talking points that the pro-petroleum industry has put together and planted in the minds of environmentalists. I mean, really, a lot more cobalt is being mined in the Congo to build jets that Poland might give to Ukraine. A lot more. I mean, the general Air Force, right. Navy air industry uses a lot more cobalt than cars do. Now, in the future, cars will use more batteries. There will be more demand as we go from, well, I don't know how many electric cars are at that. Maybe there's 10 million electric cars and we need about 100 million. But I will point out that cobalt is an element. And when you use it in a battery, it's encased and enclosed in that battery. So that battery, when that battery is no longer usable, that cobalt is still there. All of it is still there. And you can take it out and use it in a different battery. So we're not
like... Well, the other thing too is about them, the battery in a car is considered end of life at 80% rechargeability. And so those batteries can be taken and they can be used for basic energy storage in other industries too. So it's not like they get dumped.
Right. They don't get dumped. They shouldn't get dumped. But also the thing is, once we have filled up our need of batteries, we're not going to be adding cobalt. We're going to be recycling cobalt.
Sure.
Oversimplification. And everything said about that is also true. So I should mention the alloys that they use with the cobalt. There's superior alloys that use other elements that don't include cobalt, but the industries just aren't there to build them right now. So with an influx of funding, you could probably retool the industry. So you simply overnight double the availability of cobalt. So anyway, as you said to me the other day, engineers are solving these problems at a much faster rate than environmentalists. People who are predisposed to environmentalism know about them.
Yeah.
You know, so they're falsehoods. And so one thing I do, like I do the laundry thing and the dishwasher thing, but another thing I do is I try to provide information about these falsehoods and about other issues to fellow activists and environmentalists in various different contexts through writing, in talks, and just in groups. You know, it's just when people are in a group and someone mentions something about, like I'm in an indivisible group, maybe we're going to ask someone to come and talk to us about electric cars. And someone in the group says, yeah, but I want to hear the year, but, and then I'll explain politely, usually, why they're, you know, completely wrong about what they just, about everything they think about environmental issues. So that's pushing the pendulum a little bit, that pendulum. If you can push that pendulum a little bit every day or every few days, it'll keep going and you can have an impact that way.
I want to mention one last thing. I sat in on a Zoom conference with Bill McKibben. This was last year. And I've been thinking about different things that I can do with my yard, or as they say in England, my garden. It is a small yard. It's, you know, it's not even an acre. But what can people do as far as fighting global warming just in our own yards? And one of the things that he mentioned was that even if you take 10% of your yard and change it over from grass into something that's usable by pollinators, by birds, by or you know, just wildflowers or native flowers, just let them grow naturally, you do a couple of different things. Is you because most of the grass that we use requires a lot of energy, you're cutting it, you know, and it doesn't root very deeply, and so there's a lot of runoff, so a lot of issues with a lot of the different grasses that we plant in our yards. But if you plant natives, even in 10%, if everybody in St. Paul, for example, was to plant 10% wildflowers, there'd be several different benefits. One of the things would be it would reduce the runoff of chemicals into the sewage system and into the drain system into the river, which is our mighty Mississippi. And the other thing too is that it would allow less emissions from unnatural sources that come from a short grass from cutting. But the other thing too is that since there's going to be like caterpillars and stuff like that in there, it does bring in birds for people to view because they come in and they eat.
Right.
And they like to eat there. So there's a lot of things that you can do on a small scale that'll have big effects over the long run.
Yeah, and I think that's a great example also because it is a great example of how culture determines these things.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's big grain flat lawn. That is a cultural decision. It's a norm. It's a norm.
Yeah.
Big green flat, and people look at other people's lawns and they think, those are bad people. They have dandelions.
Yeah.
No, they have dead spots. They didn't water their lawn during the drought.
Yeah.
Who does that? You know, and it's changing. The culture is changing, but there's no doubt that there's a culture. And you live in, so for those again who come out who are not from around here, St. Paul and certain parts of Minneapolis are famous. You think about what's Minnesota famous for? Snow, blizzards, cold. No. St. Paul and parts of Minneapolis are famous for their perennial gardens.
Right.
Both in front of and behind the houses. And you have a perennial garden, right? Is it still alive or did you kill it? Abuse. Well, I mean, you moved into a house with
I'm a perennial garden. I'm changing over to what I want in there. I've got some native wild bird seed, not bird seed, but wildflower seeds and stuff like that I'm going to start planting. And so I'm kind of changing it over from what it was. But I don't really know exactly what I'm doing, kind of learning as I go. So we'll see how successful it is.
Yeah, but, it's a very Minnesotan thing. And you're a native Minnesotan.
And I am a native Minnesotan from northern Minnesota, yeah.
I know people.
It's cold. Yeah.
I know Garrison Keillor got canceled, but there was a really funny skit. He did it with the Lake Wobegon skit, in which a young couple was living in, they left Lake Wobegon, or one of them was from Lake Wobegon maybe, and they were now living in California, and they got married. When they got married, they came back to get married in Minnesota. So there was a gathering of the family at their wedding, you know, and when they were talking, they started talking about gardens, because of course a bunch of Minnesotans get together, someone will start talking about their garden. And so they were talking about gardens, and they started talking about their garden in California. And as this gets going on, I'm thinking of my sister who lived in San Jose, and her garden was just amazing. But they had a gardener.
Oh.
Okay. So these people are in the skit, in the Garrison Keillor skit, and like talk about their garden. And at some point, someone says, how do you get time to do that? And they said, well, the gardener comes in 3 times a week. And everyone in the entire room stopped talking, stopped eating, forks dropped. Because in Minnesota, having someone take care of your garden is like having someone cut your food for you.
Right.
Like it just isn't why you garden. It wasn't the gardens. Oh. It's not what it's an experience. It's an act of, you know, a being that you do. It's not, the garden is not the point. Well, it's the point. It's the gardening that's the point. Yeah.
Keeps me closer to my roots.
Yeah, right. Literally. Speaking of roots, one other thing I'll just mention, and again, this goes back to the activism because I just did some activism on this. I'm one of the people who puts out a newsletter that goes to about 10,000-12,000 Minnesotans every Monday on specifically activists working in groups about what to call your legislator about now.
Oh, sure.
Okay. Yep. And one of the things that came up now is the Forever Green program, which my representative Ginny Cleborn, who represents 42B, helped initiate and got some funding for. So the Forever Green program is a program coming out of Minnesota where there's two aspects of it. One is they're creating new cultivars out of native plants that you can't eat, but have other great characteristics, and they're making them edible or otherwise usable.
Oh.
So there's no one eats them yet. They're not really catching on,
right,
but at least they'll be using them for something, but they're perennials. And when you're growing something usually other than corn, something short or medium,
right,
you plant this stuff and you plant your crop in rows within that other Forever Green stuff.
Right.
Okay. It drops your productivity. Like, so let's say you're growing potatoes. You'll get 10% fewer potatoes, but it costs you 45% less money to grow them. And this other crop is something. Like, you can harvest it. And yeah, sure, there's not much of a market for Kirinza, I think, is one of them now, but there will be someday. And some of it, so you can sell it. So your total net is much higher. Uh-huh. If you do this, it's called Forever Green. So the guy the people talk about this, give a talk on it. It's really interesting because they show a picture, an aerial photograph of farmland in Minnesota every month of the year. And obviously for 6 months, it's white, it's covered with snow, right? And for 6 months or 7 months, there's not snow. And for that time, for 2 months, it's green. For the other 3 months or 4 months, it's brown because they haven't planted yet, because you can't plant too early in Minnesota, or they've finished planting. And of course, there's a thing they call termination. It's an agricultural term for the chemical you've spread on your field to kill everything that's there at the end of your harvest. So between planting in the early summer and termination in the early fall, there's 2.5 months or so where there's green. And the rest of the time it's brown. During that time, the roots that are in there are deteriorating. The CO2 is leaving the soil. The rain is washing the soil away.
Right.
Or you do this forever green thing, in which case you're basically trapping carbon. It's not much, but you're trapping carbon all growing season. You are, and the result is the amount of nitrogen fertilizer you have to put down.
Right.
Because it's trapped is like, really a small percentage of what you normally put, like a fourth or something of what you normally put down, depends on the crop. So and pesticides, you use far fewer pesticides in these conditions also. So the total amount of money you spend on the chemicals you're using on your garden, on your farmland is like a third. And that's why the profit's higher.
Wow.
So it's really an amazing system, and farmers are,
so they're not plowing. So because of the fact that they got the perennials in there, they're not going to be plowing, which is another source of carbon dioxide emanations from your fields as they turn it over. Right.
Yeah. And there's other forms of farming where you don't do farming. I mean, you don't do plowing and stuff, but
like
this is one.
Like regenerative, where you rotate with cattle and stuff like that.
Right. This is one of those methods. But the Forever Green Program is coming out of Minnesota, and, you know, the legislator got them funding. And now we're going for another $50 million for this year. And so, and there are farmers taking it up and doing it, and they're mixing it. Some farmers are doing organic farming with this. Uh-huh. Some farmers are not. But it's like you're doing in your house. And which brings us to an interesting point. All the stuff you can do matters. But it's also true that sometimes policy changes matter a lot more than personal changes. But I think personal changes would matter more if we did the right ones.
Mm.
Like your dishwashing thing. I think a lot of people would think it's a machine, so it's worse. I'm going to clean my dishes the organic way with my hands and run water. But in fact, that's backwards. You know, so it's helpful to know. So the person who goes in the grocery store and there's tomatoes and there's some more tomatoes, and some of them are wrapped in plastic. Let's avoid buying the ones wrapped in plastic, right?
Exactly.
Okay, but how do you know what else happened to these tomatoes in their lifespan? They were wrapped in plastic earlier, I guarantee you. They came into that store wrapped in plastic.
Displayed, yeah.
Yeah, so I would tend to think that the one that's wrapped in plastic, if you avoid that one, you're probably using less plastic. But I'd want to know the background, the pedigree of these tomatoes to know how much CO2 went into the atmosphere because they were shipped here. Like, are any of these flown here from Venezuela or someplace, you know, in an airplane versus shipped from California, which in Minnesota, we have to get our food from California, Florida, Texas, whatever, Mexico. A lot of our food comes from Mexico during the dead of winter. So I'd like to see policy that puts in place the information that lets us be able to make personal decisions that are better informed.
I think every year since I've been active, there's been pushes to have like origin labels on produce.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how far they get, but yeah, I mean, I mean, I'm kind of guilty of raising the demand for the yellow mangoes that are only grown in Chiapas, Mexico. So I guess I'm not pure.
That's not that far, though. Chiapas, Mexico is not as far as China or Australia, where my sub came from. You can drive to Chiapas, Mexico in a truck.
That's true.
I just think that we've demonstrated there's a lot of different levels to think about these problems on.
Yeah.
And you can do, and anybody can do more than they're doing now without it being too painful.
Right.
And yep. It can matter. It can help.
It can matter. We don't all have to live in a mound out in the middle of the woods growing mushrooms on our roof in order to be a good environmentally active people.
Right. Not everybody has to live in a yurt in Vermont, but we do appreciate the fact that there are people in Vermont living in yurts.
Yeah. So I just want to thank you for listening to this edition of Iconocast. This was just Greg and Mike talking about different things that you can do in your daily life to reduce your impact on global warming and things that you can do to talk to politicians that are also responsible for the larger things beyond your house. You may have noticed that the podcast is ad-free, commercial-free, Patreon support request-free, but there are ways that you can support us. And if you share, rate, and review enough, eventually you won't be one of our lonely listeners and we'll be a worldwide podcast changing the world. Thank you again. Have a great week and listen for the next episode.